Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm really going to mix it up this week. Here's a show about as far away from snowflakes, gingerbread, and holiday shopping as you can get. Yeah, that's right. See, this show is all about mobsters, factual, and fictional. And our guest today has just written one incredible gangsta book. So, guys and malls, let's turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
And here's more on Mickey Cohen and the underbelly of the City of Angels. Paul Lieberman's The Gangster Squad chronicles the true story of the secretive police unit that waged an anything-goes war to drive Mickey Cohen and other hoods from L.A. after World War II. In 1946, the LAPD launched the Gangster Squad with eight men who met covertly on street corners and slept with Tommy guns under their beds. But for two cops, all that mattered was nailing Mickey. Sergeant Jack O'Mara was a church usher. Sergeant Jerry Wooters, a cynical maverick. So O'Mara set a trap to prove Mickey was a killer, and Wooters formed an alliance with Mickey's budding rival, Jack the Enforcer Whalen. Two cops, two hoodlums. Their fates collided in the closing days of the 50s, when one night the Enforcer confronted Mickey and his crew. The aftermath would shake both LA's mob and police department and signal the end of a defining era in the city's history. Robert Petkoff narrates.
Mickey said Big Maxie had come at him with a .45, the one found by the body, so he had no choice but to plug the burly bookie with the .38 he kept in his desk. Since then, another bookmaker, Polly Gibbons, had been shot seven times on a Beverly Hills street. Next to fall in 1946 were Chicago natives Benny the Meatball Gamson and George Levinson. That dual execution generating the Gangsters in Gambling War headline that was the last straw for Los Angeles officials, and the reason Lieutenant Willie Burns assembled 18 hand-picked candidates for a secretive new squad that October. "You'll be working with these," Burns told them as he hoisted the Tommy gun and slid in its circular 50-round drum. The deal was, if they joined him, they would continue to be listed on the rosters of their old stations while operating out of two rusted old Fords. They would not make arrests. If someone had to be booked, they'd call in homicide, vice, or robbery. They would also be available for other chores, as Chief C.B. Horrell saw fit. They would have cash at their disposal, a Secret Service fund to pay informants who might help them gather intelligence on the likes of Bugsy, Dragna, and Mickey Cohen. But they would have no office. They'd meet on street corners, in parking lots, and up in the hills. In effect, they would not exist. Burns gave the 18 men a week to ponder his invitation and some advice from an old lieutenant at the 77th who said an assignment like that could get you in good with the chief or even make you a hero.
"Or you could end up down in San Pedro walking a beat in a fog."
Sergeant Jack O'Mara puffed on his pipe as the old lieutenant cautioned them,
"Whatever you do, keep your nose clean."
After the week to think it over, only seven came back to join Willie Burns, making a gangster squad of 8. One was O'Mara, who had to explain to his wife Connie what was in the stylish black violin case he began keeping under their bed. Sergeant Jerry Wooters came on board later. He was not a church usher or a pipe smoker. He went for cigars or cigarettes, which he dangled from the corner of his mouth. Gerard Jerry Wooters was lean and angular. He was all about playing the angles. He was the son of an itinerant gold miner who had come to California following its oldest get-rich-quick fantasy, but mostly stayed poor. Jerry tried to avoid the war, but couldn't, then got shot down over the Pacific and was left floating in a raft. If a Japanese boat found him first, he was dead. If an American ship found him, he'd come home with medals. After he came home with his medals, he kept photos of himself with the comely nurses who helped him recover. As a policeman, he displayed the same screw-you defiance to the crooks and his bosses alike. On his first case for the gangster squad, he led the investigation that changed the ground rules for policing in California. Jerry Wooters and Jack O'Mara had nothing in common except for their rank as sergeants and their shared obsession with Mickey Cohen. In time, O'Mara set a trap for Mickey, using his own guns to prove he was a killer. Wooters forged an alliance with Mickey's budding rival of the 1950s, Jack the Enforcer Whalen, a powerhouse of a man who took pride in never needing a gun. His fists were enough, and had dreams of making it in Hollywood. Neither cop told the other what he had done.
That was Gangster Squad by Paul Lieberman. Dennis Lehane is the best-selling author of 9 previous novels, including Gone Baby Gone and Mystic River. Now Dennis is back with Live by Night, a gritty gangsta-era novel that Janet Maslin of the New York Times has called a sentence-by-sentence pleasure. Before becoming a full-time writer, Boston-born Lehane worked as a counselor with mentally challenged and abused children. He waited tables, parked cars, drove limos, worked in bookstores, and loaded tractor trailers. As he tells it, his one regret is that no one ever gave him a chance to tend bar. Readers, I am so thrilled to introduce Dennis Lehane on the Book Report. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dennis.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Live by Night begins in Boston, travels to Tampa, and next Havana. Why these cities?
It's the rum route, actually, in reverse. That was actually the first plan I ever had for the book was rum came out of Havana across the Florida Straits, was often entered through the section of Tampa called Ybor City, and then was trucked across to Jacksonville and run up the eastern seaboard to Boston, New York, etc. So I knew that I was going to start the book in Boston, and then I was going to go backwards, and I was going to go have my main character end up running a little fiefdom in Tampa, and then have the sort of the denouement of the book occur in Cuba. Mm. Wind it down.
You write, the night has its own set of rules. Is that why the book is called Live by Night?
Yeah, it is. Partially that, and partially the idea that during Prohibition, the vast majority of people live by night. The vast majority of people broke the law. The vast majority of people turned their back on conventional mores and conventional society. I mean, that's what I called it, the Roaring Twenties, because it was rocking.
Yeah. The main character, of course, is Joe Coughlin, and his dad was a cop. I thought that the way you wrote the father-son relationship was amazing. Can you tell the readers about that?
Well, yeah, their father and son, Joe, was a sort of accident to the marriage. He was the youngest of a family of three, and his father is a quite respected and quite powerful deputy superintendent of the Boston Police Department. And Joe has always rejected everything about him, even though, paradoxically, they love each other very much and are very much alike. But Joe has said, you know, he knows that his father is, for all his respect, I'm not going to pretend I'm anything else.
I'm sorry. He differentiates between being an outlaw and a gangster. How does he see the difference?
Well, the distinction he makes is that, that an outlaw is essentially somebody who just doesn't, has no desire to play by the rules of society. It's simple as that. What a gangster is somebody who, in some ways, is indistinguishable from what he dislikes about his father. I mean, the gangster is the outlaw gone corporate. So, an outlaw is somebody who lives on the margins. A gangster is somebody who creates an illegal company, essentially. And then adheres to all the rules, in a way, of a society, which Joe has no interest in, or he thinks he has no interest in. But as the book progresses, the line between gangster and outlaw gets very blurred.
Yeah. I loved how you wrote about Joe's attachment to his father's watch. Talk about that a little bit.
His father at one point gave him a watch, and it's a watch that had extreme significance to his father. It was given to him after rescuing somebody from a robbery many years before. And so, but even that story, one of the things that you see repeated over and over and over again in the book is that behind the legend, the truth is very different. And so the story behind the watch, as Joe understands it, isn't even the true story. It's something that he carries through the book and becomes very much a metaphor for other things, which I don't believe is my best for the reader to figure out what those are.
Okay, some of the mobsters in the book, I'm wondering if they were based on actual people or, for example, I love the name Mean Mo Mullen. Did you create that or were they based on real folks?
No, I created that. Everybody had names like that back then, or at least they did in the literature, as I understand. It's very Damien, it's Runyon-esque is the way they put it. Damien Runyon was a great writer of that time, and all people always had crazy names like Mean Joe Mullins in his stories. And you look back at the comic strips of the time, you look back at the gangster movies of the time, and everybody had these really wild and colorful monikers. So I used those when I could. Although Joe's a very simple name. He's just Joe Coughlin, and the man he works for is Maso Pescatori, and the the chief enemy is a man named Albert White. So those guys don't have nicknames, but a lot of people in the book pop around with these odd and strange names because I was trying to give you the spice of the time, the flavor of the time.
Yeah, there's a question that runs through the book: can good deeds follow bad money? Tell us how you handled that.
Well, it's a question. It's a question I think we all grapple with. There's no Balzac line, behind every fortune is a crime. And I think that we've been questioning it the last 10 years. Certainly, that's the underlying question of gunboat diplomacy. Can you go and blow a country up for its own good, and then rebuild it? And some countries are very much better off, but would they prefer to have free choice? It's a question that goes back to the Romans. I mean, the Romans came in and gave all these civilizations that they overran. They gave them water. They gave them crops. They gave them farming systems. They gave them irrigation. They gave them sanitation. And yet at the same time, they killed a lot of people to do it. So that just becomes the question of the book. Joe is thinking in terms of what he has done. By the end, there's a lot of dead bodies because Joe Coughlin exists. And yet he retains this part of his heart that wants to do good. And then he is, by this point, involved very heavily with a Cuban woman, and she is representative of a country that was, at that point, very much under the foot of American power. So it became her interpretation of whether you can do it or not is very different than his.
Yeah. And of course, Graciela does a lot of good in her community in many different ways.
Yes. She is constantly trying to fight against what may be partially a truth of her, which is that she has become what she's most concerned with is becoming a cafe, cafe rebel. Somebody sits around and talks about revolution in cafes who doesn't do anything about it. And once she falls for Joe, she loses a little bit of her edge. And so then she begins to turn that into philanthropy.
Yeah. Live by Night is not a sequel of The Given Day, but there is a connection. Will the characters in Live by Night continue in any future books?
Yes. They'll be in the next book, some of them.
Ah, all right. So
the idea is to continue looking at the bloodline, but not necessarily feel as if, I don't want anybody to ever feel, any reader to ever feel as if they're missing something when they read one of the books, if they haven't read the others. So you can read Live by Night and never even know the given day existed. And that's very purposeful, because then if you did know it existed or you find out it existed, you go, oh, I wonder what these characters were like 10 years earlier.
So are you already writing the next book?
Yeah, I'm well into it.
Uh-huh. And are there any plans for a movie of Live by Night?
Yeah, Live by Night has been optioned, right at this moment, Ben Affleck is set to write and direct the adaptation.
Wow. So when might that make it to the big screen?
I have no idea. Could be next year, could be 10 years.
I want to tell the readers that this was a book that I read in a day and a half because I couldn't put it down. And you really kind of captured a sense of time and place. I loved it.
Thank you. It's wonderful to hear.
Well, you're very welcome. And readers, you want to either get the audio version right away or pick this one up. Thanks so much for joining us today.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Live by Night by Dennis Lehane, performed by Jim Frangione.
Dion Bartolo hit him in the mouth with his pistol. Hit him hard enough to knock him out of his chair and draw some blood. Got everyone else thinking how much better it was to be the one who wasn't getting pistol whipped than the one who was. Joe said, "Everyone but the girl, get on your knees. Put your hands behind your head and lace the fingers." Brenny Loomis locked eyes with Joe. "I'll call your mother when this is over, boy. Suggest a nice dark suit for your coffin." Loomis, a former club boxer at Mechanics Hall and sparring partner for Mean Mo Mullins, was said to have a punch like a bag of cue balls. He killed people for Albert White. Not for a living, exclusively, but rumor was he wanted Albert to know, should it ever become a full-time position, he had seniority. Joe had never experienced fear like he did looking into Loomis's tiny brown eyes, but he gestured at the floor with his gun nonetheless, quite surprised that his hand didn't shake. Brendan Loomis laced his hands behind his head and got on his knees. Once he did, the others did the same. Joe said to the girl, "Come over here, miss. We won't harm you." She stubbed out her cigarette and looked at him like she was thinking about lighting another, maybe freshening her drink. She crossed to him, a girl near his own age, maybe 20 or so, with winter eyes and skin so pale he could almost see through it to the blood and tissue underneath. He watched her come as the Bartolo brothers relieved the card players of their weapons. The pistols made heavy thumps as they tossed them onto a nearby blackjack table. But the girl didn't even flinch. In her eyes, firelights danced behind the gray. She stepped up to his gun and said, "And what will the gentleman be having with his robbery this morning?" Joe handed her one of the two canvas sacks he'd carried in. "The money on the table, please."
"Coming right up, sir."
As she crossed back to the table, he pulled one pair of handcuffs from the other sack, then tossed the sack to Paolo. Paolo bent by the first card player and handcuffed his wrists at the small of his back, then moved on to the next. The girl swept the pot off the center of the table, Joe noting not just bills but watches and jewelry in there too, then gathered up everyone's stakes. Paolo finished cuffing the men on the floor and went to work gagging them. Joe scanned the room, the roulette wheel behind him, the craps table against the wall under the stairs. He counted three blackjack tables and one baccarat table. Six slot machines took up the rear wall. A low table with a dozen phones on top constituted the wire service. A board behind it listing the horses from last night's 12th race at Reedville. The only other door besides the one they'd come through was chalkmarked with a T for toilet, which made sense, because people had to piss when they drank. Except that when Joe had come through the bar, he'd seen two bathrooms, which would certainly suffice, and this bathroom had a padlock on it. He looked over at Brenny Loomis, lying on the floor with a gag in his mouth, but watching the wheels turn in Joe's head. Joe watched the wheels in Loomis's head do their own turning, and he knew what he'd known the moment he saw that padlock. The bathroom wasn't a bathroom. It was the counting room. Albert White's counting room. Judging by the business Hickey Casinos had done the past 2 days, the first chilly weekend of October, Joe suspected a small fortune sat behind that door. Albert White's small fortune. The girl came back to him with the bag of poker swag. "Your dessert, sir," she said and handed him the bag. He couldn't get over how level her gaze was. She didn't just stare at him. She stared through him. He was certain she could see his face behind the handkerchief and the low hat. Some morning he'd pass her walking to get cigarettes, hear her yell, "That's him!" He wouldn't even have time to close his eyes before the bullets hit him. He took the sack and dangled the set of cuffs from his finger. "Turn around." "Yes, sir. Right away, sir."
We've just heard Live by Night by Dennis Lehane. The Scarpas were a mafia dynasty led by Greg Scarpa Sr., a man so addicted to killing, he was nicknamed the Grim Reaper. His son, Gregory Jr., worshipped him and was drawn into his dark world. Mafia Son, The Scarpa Mob Family, The FBI, and A Story of Betrayal by Sandra Harmon tells their story. For 30 years, starting in the 60s, Scarpa Sr. was an informant, working intimately with his FBI handlers. For decades, his connection to the FBI protected him and gave him a virtual license to kill. But faced with arrest in the late 1980s, Greg dropped the dime on his own son. Gregory Jr. was imprisoned alongside terrorist Ramzi Youssef. He offered to trade information on Youssef with the government in exchange for leniency. He was to provide detailed intelligence on what would eventually result in the September 11th attacks, and more. His warnings were ignored, and he was sentenced to 40 years to life in prison, where he remains. The story gained national notoriety at former FBI agents Lynn DeVecchio's sensational murder trial of 2007, at which author Sandra Harmon testified. Oliver Wyman narrates this tale of violence, wealth, and sex.
Inmates have almost no physical contact with anyone. Corrections officers, for example, approach inmate cells through a vestibule. Bars separate the vestibule from the solid steel doors of the cell, providing a second barrier and allowing the COs to safely handcuff inmates before removing them from their cells for transport or exercise. As with food, mail and laundry are delivered through a slot in the steel bars. Meals are either typical American diner fare, casseroles, hamburgers, and blue plate specials, or foods conforming to almost all religious restrictions. No pork, an abundance of beans and vegetables. During the month of Ramadan, Muslims are afforded certain courtesies, such as taking their meals in the evening hours, but these are rare exceptions. From the prison nerve center, officers and other staff maintain control through the use of a wide array of sophisticated electronic surveillance equipment. Doors are opened and closed by remote control, and almost always from a safe distance. Corridors are lined with cameras and microphones, making it almost impossible for an inmate to escape the watchful eye of prison administrators. The goal here is not rehabilitation. The goal is confinement, punishment. The safety of staff and officers is paramount at all times. Gregory Scarpa Jr. is 5'6" tall with a thick, muscular build, gray beard, and an assortment of tattoos. Though short in stature, he is a physically impressive man. Prematurely bald, he no longer sports the rather conspicuous and obvious toupee he wore in his youth. And yet, there is an undeniable sadness in his eyes, something in his demeanor that suggests nothing so much as regret. He passes the endless hours exercising in his cell, watching TV, and writing long letters to his 4 children, Corey, Diane, Gregory III, and Maria, at 20 his youngest. He says that he attempts to be a father to them through daily letters. To date, however, he has rebuffed their overtures to visit. He says he would love to hold his children, to feel their touch and to hear their voices, to feel their breath against his cheek. But even if they were permitted to visit, there is no assurance they would be allowed any sort of intimacy, and the longing he feels, the sadness that comes with isolation, is offset by the pain he imagines they would feel if they saw him in this cell, chained and shackled, their encounter mitigated by a plexiglass barrier. 5 days a week, for 1 hour a day, Gregory is removed from his cell and transported to a small, indoor steel mesh cage about half the size of his cell. Inmates call it the kennel, or dog run, because that is precisely what it resembles. Leaving his cell for even this brief interlude involves an extraordinary ordeal for Gregory. Two guards enter his cell and order him to strip. After a cavity search, including a pointedly humiliating anal examination, he dresses again and his hands are cuffed through a slot in the steel bars. Then the guards, with steel-tipped batons at the ready, accompany him down a long, narrow corridor. At all times, their movements are tracked by video monitors. Nothing is left to chance. Exercise hour is exactly that, 1 hour. Afterward, the moving process begins again, including a second degrading cavity search. He then sits in his tiny cell for the next 23 hours, waiting for the next meal, for mail, for anything that will help interrupt the crushing monotony and sameness that typify his life.
That was Mafia Son by Sandra Harmon.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
And now for those with classic tastes. The Book Report has searched the bookshelves and presents Graham Greene's gang war thriller, Brighton Rock. Written in the late 1930s, this is the tale of the gang war raging through Brighton's dark underworld. Pinky, malign and ruthless, has killed a man. Believing he can escape retribution, he is unprepared for the courageous, life-embracing Ida Arnold, who is determined to avenge a death. Samuel West narrates.
With his inky fingers and his bitten nails, his manner cynical and nervous, anybody could tell he didn't belong. Belong to the early summer sun, the cool Whitsun wind off the sea, the holiday crowd. They came in by train from Victoria every 5 minutes, rocked down Queen's Road standing on the tops of the little local trams, stepped off in bewildered multitudes into fresh and glittering air. The new silver paint sparkled on the piers. The cream houses ran away into the west like a pale Victorian watercolour. A race in miniature motors, a band playing, flower gardens in bloom below the front, an aeroplane advertising something for the health in pale vanishing clouds across the sky. It had seemed quite easy to Hale to be lost in Brighton. 50,000 people besides himself were down for the day, and for quite a while he gave himself up to the good day, drinking gins and tonics wherever his programme allowed. For he had to stick closely to a programme. From 10 till 11, Queen's Road and Castle Square. From 11 till 12, the Aquarium and Palace Pier. 12 till 1, the front between the Old Ship and West Pier. Back for lunch between 1 and 2 in any restaurant he chose round the Castle Square. And after that he had to make his way all down the parade to the West Pier, and then to the station by the Hove streets. These were the limits of his absurd and widely advertised Centrigo. Advertised on every messenger poster, Collie Kibber in Brighton today. In his pocket he had a packet of cards to distribute in hidden places along his route. Those who found them would receive 10 shillings from the messenger, but the big prize was reserved for whoever challenged Hale in the proper form of words and with a copy of the messenger in his hand. You are Mr. Collie Kibber. I claim the Daily Messenger prize. This was Hale's job to do sentry go until a challenger released him in every seaside town in turn. Yesterday, Southend. Today, Brighton. Tomorrow... He drank his gin and tonic hastily as a clock struck 11 and moved out of Castle Square. Collie Kibber always played fair, always wore the same kind of hat as in the photograph the messenger printed, was always on time. Yesterday in Southend he had been unchallenged. The paper liked to save its guineas occasionally, but not too often. It was his duty today to be spotted. And it was his inclination, too. There were reasons why he didn't feel too safe in Brighton, even in a Whitsun crowd. He leant against the rail near the Palace Pier and showed his face to the crowd as it uncoiled endlessly past him like a twisted piece of wire, 2 by 2, each with an air of sober and determined gaiety. They had stood all the way from Victoria in crowded carriages. They would have to wait in queues for lunch. At midnight, half asleep, they would rock back in trains to the cramped streets and the closed pubs and the weary walk home. With immense labour and immense patience, they extricated from the long day the grain of pleasure. This sun, this music, the rattle of the miniature cars, the ghost train diving between the grinning skeletons under the aquarium promenade, the sticks of Brighton rock, the paper sailors' caps. Nobody paid any attention to Hale. No one seemed to be carrying a messenger. He deposited one of his cards carefully on the top of a little basket and moved on, with his bitten nails in his inky fingers. Alone. He only felt his loneliness after his third gin. Until then he despised the crowd, but afterwards he felt his kinship. He had come out of the same streets, but he was condemned by his higher pay to pretend to want other things, and all the time the peers, the peep shows pulled at his heart. He wanted to get back, but all he could do was to carry his sneer along the front, the badge of loneliness. Somewhere out of sight, a woman was singing When I Came Up from Brighton by the Train, a rich Guinness voice, a voice from a public bar. Hale turned into the private saloon and watched her big blown charms across 2 bars and through a glass partition. She wasn't old, somewhere in the late 30s or the early 40s, and she was only a little drunk in a friendly, accommodating way.
We've just heard Brighton Rock by Graham Greene. Bonnie and Clyde, they thought. And what's his name, the sidekick? In Mad River by John Sanford, 3 teenagers with dead-end lives have both chips on their shoulders and guns. The first person the gang killed was a highway patrolman. The second, a woman. Then, why not keep it going? As their crime spree cuts a swath through rural Minnesota, some of it captured on the killer cell phones and sent to a local TV station, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension investigator Virgil Flowers joins the growing army of cops trying to run them down. But even he doesn't realize what's about to happen. Eric Conger narrates the 6th novel in the Virgil Flowers series.
As the car went by, a woman driver peered out at the three of them. The overhead reading light was on, and she was wearing an overcoat, wool hat, and 1 black glove. Her bare hand was holding a cell phone to her ear, and she was talking as she looked at them. A multitasker, headed for a 3-car smash-up somewhere down the line. One big problem there. Somebody would have seen it and put 2 and 2 together, and then we got a witness, Jimmy said. Besides, the walk'll warm you up. Glad I got the gloves, McCall said. Becky Welsh said, It's April, you fool. You don't need gloves for the cold. Just walk. Jimmy had smoked a Marlboro down to the filter, and he snapped it into the street and bent into the task of climbing the hill, Tom and Becky on his heels, the three of them throwing splashy shadows in the pale April moonlight. Halfway up, Jimmy stopped to catch his breath, turned and said, "That's a pretty sight of the town." They all turned to look. The Bingham business district spread out below them, the county courthouse with its eternal flame, a few cars turning corners, flashing red lights on an ambulance heading into the hospital. The Minnesota River was down there, a black ribbon at the foot of downtown. Not much more than a creek, really. They'd left Jimmy's Firebird in an apartment parking lot at the base of the hill, where they could get to it in a hurry. "It is pretty," Tom agreed. Puffs of steam came out of their mouths, dissipating in the night air. Jimmy took another cigarette out of the pack and tapped the tobacco end on a thumbnail, then cupped his hands to his mouth and lit it with an old Zippo lighter that left behind the stink of lighter fluid when he sparked it off. His square jaw looked yellow in the light of the flame. The trace of a ladder-stitched scar showed up on his chin, from the bad old hay-humping days down in Shinder when a piece of wire from an ancient baling machine lashed him like a whip. He was wearing a green army field jacket that he'd bought at a flea market, with a collar up under his ears, and a blue Dodgers baseball cap with a big white L.A. on the front. He'd never been to L.A., but he planned to go someday soon. He'd manage Becky's career, and they'd both get rich and buy a Winnebago and tour around the country. "Diamonds tonight," Becky said. Tom said, "I don't know about this. It don't feel entirely right to me." Tom was tall and wiry and wore silver-rimmed glasses that he got from the 3 weeks he was in the Navy. At the end of 3 weeks, one of the RDCs noticed the scale in his arms and asked, "Is that the heartbreak of psoriasis I see there?" It was, and Tom was out. On this cold night, the psoriasis was concealed by a thin blue work shirt and an uninsulated leather jacket, the sleeves too short to cover Tom's bony wrists. With his black jacket and black jeans and black hair and glasses and big nose, he hovered around Jimmy and Becky like a cartoon crow. "Don't be a—" Becky said. "It's diamonds," Jimmy said. He rolled the words around the cigarette as he studied Tom's pinched face. "What's the matter with you? You look nervous. You nervous?" "Nah, I'm not nervous. Just want things to go right," Tom said. They crossed the top of the hill, heads down, hands in their pockets, around the curve, and past George, past Arroyo. They were in the dark, with nobody around, a quarter to 2 o'clock in the morning, a sharp eye out for prowling cops. Jimmy had a pistol stuck in his waistband at the small of his back, and he reached back under his coat and touched it from time to time, a talisman of power. He'd never had one of those. "Getting close," Becky said. Now she sounded nervous. They passed a street light, and in the pool of light, which fell on them like a mist, she said, "Stop a minute, Jimmy." She caught his arm and pulled his cigarette hand out to one side and kissed him and put her tongue in his mouth and pressed her pelvis against him. He tasted like nicotine and French fries. Jimmy said, "Baby," and stepped back and took a drag and tipped his head into a dark side street and said, "Let's go."
That was Mad River by John Sanford. Don Winslow's The Power of the Dog is an explosive novel of the drug trade that takes you deep inside a world riddled with corruption, betrayal, and bloody revenge. Art Montana is an obsessive DEA agent. The Barrera brothers are heirs to a drug empire. Nora Hayden is a jaded teen who becomes a high-class hooker. Father Parada is a powerful and incorruptible Catholic priest. And Callan is an Irish kid from Hell's Kitchen who grows up to be a merciless hitman. All of them are trapped in the world of the Mexican drug Federación. From the streets of New York to Mexico City and Tijuana and the jungles beyond, this is the war on drugs like you've never seen it. Ray Porter narrates the novel The Washington Post has called a pit bull of a book.
Children, Art thinks, pulled out of sleep, grab their toys and hold on to them, even as, especially as, the guns roar. An irrational image comes to him, a stuffed elephant, a childhood toy he always slept with. It had one button eye, it was stained with vomit, with urine, with all the various childhood effluvia, and it smelled of all of them. His mother had sneaked it away in his sleep and replaced it with a new elephant with two eyes and a pristine aroma, and when Art woke up, he thanked her for the new elephant, and then found and retrieved the old one from the trash. Arthur Keller hears his own heart break. He switches his gaze to the adult victims. Some are in pajamas, expensive silk pajamas and negligees, some in t-shirts. One body lies alone along the opposite wall. An old man, the head of the family. Probably shot last, Art thinks, forced to watch his family killed and then dispatched himself. Meaning that they thought someone in his family was a dedo, a finger, an informer. Because I led them to believe that. God forgive me. He searches through the bodies until he finds the one he's looking for. They shot him in the mouth. Traitors get shot in the back of the head. Informers, in the mouth. They thought it was him. Which was exactly what you wanted them to think, Art tells himself. Face it, it worked just the way you planned. But I never envisioned this, he thinks. I never thought they'd do this. They must have been servants, Art says. Workers. The police have already checked the workers' quarters. Gone, one of the cops says. Disappeared. Vanished. He forces himself to look at the bodies again. It's my fault, Art thinks. I brought this on these people. I'm sorry, Art thinks. I am so, so sorry. Bending over the mother and child, Art makes the sign of the cross and whispers, In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
El poder del perro,
he hears one of the Mexican cops murmur. The power of the dog.
That was The Power of the Dog by Don Winslow.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Mickey Cohen, the life and times of L.A.'s notorious mobster, is a seductive, high-octane blend of true crime and Hollywood lore. When Bugsy Siegel was executed, Mickey Cohen, a former pro boxer, took over L.A.'s criminal activities in a move sanctioned by Meyer Lansky and Frank Costello. Attaining immense power and dominance from the late 40s until 76, the semi-literate Cohen became an above-the-fold newspaper name. Cohen's story and the history of mid-century L.A. are inextricably intertwined, and author Tere Tariba writes of high life, high drama, and highly placed politicians, including RFK and Richard Nixon. There are also revelations about icons as diverse as Shirley Temple, Lana Turner, Frank Sinatra, and the Reverend Billy Graham. Meticulously researched, the book is a panoramic look at the L.A. underworld. Narrator Kate Redding immerses the listener in a dark, decadent, and dangerous side of Hollywood.
Among waves of Jewish immigrants escaping the poverty and anti-Semitism experienced in Tsarist Russia, Mickey Cohen's parents, Max and Fanny, made their way to the United States in the first years of the 20th century. Indigent, uneducated, and unable to speak the language, the couple settled into the ghetto neighborhood of Brownsville, Brooklyn. Max Cohen was in some kind of import business with Jewish fishes, as Mickey would later describe his father's occupation. There were already five children in the household, three older boys and two small daughters, when Meyer Harris, called Mickey, arrived on September 4, 1913. Max died 2 months later. His youngest child had no memory of him. Told his father had been a good provider who adapted quickly in America, Mickey Cohen later portrayed his father as a man of religion and integrity.
"According to the rest of the family," he said, "he was orthodox in his faith, and very orthodox in his attitude toward the sanctity of the family and home."
Left with six children and little else, in 1915, Fanny boldly embarked to Los Angeles, America's newest city. Leaving the older children with relatives, Mickey, barely two, and Lillian, his four-year-old sister, accompanied her. By then, Los Angeles had already tasted boom times. Founded in 1781 by Spanish missionaries, the region was controlled by Mexico beginning in 1821 until it became a territory of the United States after the Mexican-American War of 1846. Dramatic change would not happen until decades later, when in 1876, the Southern Pacific Railroad transformed the geographically isolated cowtown. With the opening of the railroad, commerce began to flourish, making Los Angeles a viable destination for tourists and settlers. Then oil was discovered. With people flooding the area, real estate development and speculation took off. Located 8 miles west of downtown, Hollywood was one of scores of new hamlets that sprang up in the patchwork of empty land, orange groves, and oil and bean fields that defined the sprawling yet sparsely populated city of Los Angeles. Using his political clout, William H. Workman, who later became mayor of the city, proposed a development for the white-collared middle classes 2 miles east of downtown. After a bridge linking the area to the central city was built across the Los Angeles River, ground was broken in 1875. Situated on a bluff, with commanding views of downtown to the west, the community of Boyle Heights was born. Boyle Heights was Fanny Cohen's destination. By the time she arrived, due to discriminatory residential laws and escalating prices in other areas, the neighborhood had devolved into the city's melting pot, populated by immigrants, mainly Eastern European Jews, and also Mexicans, Italians, Russians, Japanese, and Chinese. The narrow streets were dotted with tiny one-story houses. The rundown frame cottages were no different from those in the oldest sections of Hollywood, or the shotgun shacks of Venice at the Sea, the beachside village at the end of the Pacific Electric's red car line. But culturally, Boyle Heights developed a much different tone. Los Angeles was home to the largest Jewish population west of Chicago, and Boyle Heights had grown into a sun-drenched variation of Manhattan's Lower East Side. Yiddish was spoken in homes and on the streets, and all types of establishments catered to the needs of the residents. Brooklyn Avenue, the neighborhood's main thoroughfare, was lined with tiny shops and signage in Yiddish, religious bookstores, kosher butchers and bakeries, delicatessens and grocery stores, pickle barrels outside the doors.
That was Mickey Cohen, The Life and Times of L.A.'s Notorious Mobster by Terry Tariba. In Original Gangster, the real-life story of one of America's most notorious drug lords, Frank Lucas recounts his true life as the former heroin dealer and organized crime boss who ran Harlem during the late 60s and early 70s. Determined to break the Italian mafia's monopoly over drug smuggling in New York, Frank cut out the middleman and began smuggling heroin directly into the U.S. from his source in Vietnam. He used the coffins of dead American soldiers, making $1 million per day from his blue magic, the purest heroin on the street. Lucas became one of the most powerful crime lords of his time, while rubbing shoulders with the elite in entertainment, politics, and crime. This powerful memoir, written with Aaliyah S. King, is the story of the man whose rise and fall was dramatized in the 2007 feature film American Gangster. Carrie Height narrates the book.
"Still ain't moving fast enough, boy," he said. "Bring my coffin now. Them boys you serving can wait." I looked down at the black men sitting at the table I was serving right then. They were all men I was pretty friendly with, and they had a look in their eyes I will never forget. They were pissed off and full of rage, just like I was. We were all criminals, but that didn't mean those white boys had any right whatsoever to act like they were the wardens. I worked in the mess hall. I didn't work for him or any of his friends. And the worst part about it all, that really thought I was scared of him. He sneered at me and he had this look in his eyes that was outright daring me to challenge the way he was talking. Now, starting some trouble could mean no visitation. And I look forward to Jonita bringing my son to see me on the weekends. But I damn sure wasn't going to let Mr. Clean think he was the boss of me. I rolled a 5-gallon container of coffee over to where Mr. Clean sat. "You ready for your coffee?" I asked. "You right, boy," he said, holding out his cup and laughing. He didn't even turn around to look at me. Just held his cup in the air while I was looking at his friends. I overturned that whole container on that white boy's head and soaked him with scalding coffee from his head to his... It's pretty damn nasty what some hot coffee can do to your skin. His face immediately turned even whiter, and then blisters began to form. And then here comes some of his buddies from the table, ready to lay me out on the floor. I was so enraged that I felt like I had superhuman strength. I truly believed that I would have been able to take on every single one of them. But I didn't have to. My boys were on their feet as soon as I dumped that coffee. They had forks and homemade shanks and anything they could fashion as a weapon. Every black man in that joint had my back. We tore that room up, giving them white folks just what they deserved. We fought for I don't know how long before I found myself in a chokehold. "That's it," someone said, his hands on my shoulder. "It's over now, Lucas."
We've just heard Original Gangster by Frank Lucas with Aaliyah S. King. Happy days for John Grisham fans. Reader reviews say his new book, The Racketeer, proves that Grisham is, quote, alive and kicking. Given the importance of what they do, the controversies that surround them, and the violent people they confront, it's remarkable that in the history of this country, only 4 active federal judges have been murdered. Sadly, Judge Raymond Fawcett has just become number 5. Who is the racketeer? And what does he have to do with the judge's demise? His name for the moment is Malcolm Bannister. Job status? Former attorney. Current residence? The federal prison camp near Frostburg, Maryland. On paper, Malcolm's situation just ain't looking too good these days, but he's got an ace up his sleeve. He knows who killed Judge Fawcett and why. The judge's body was found in his remote lakeside cabin. There was no forced entry, no struggle, just 2 bodies, Judge Fawcett and his young secretary.
and one large, state-of-the-art, extremely secure safe, opened and emptied. What was in the safe? The FBI would love to know. And Malcolm Bannister would love to tell them. But everything has a price. And the racketeer wasn't born yesterday. J.D. Jackson narrates.
Until they are about 12 years old, little boys worship their fathers and believe they can do no wrong. I coached Bo in T-ball and youth soccer, and he followed me around like a puppy. We fished and camped, and he sometimes went to my office with me on Saturday mornings after a boys-only breakfast. He was my world. And trying to explain to him that I was going away for a long time broke both our hearts. Once behind bars, I refused to allow him to visit me. As much as I wanted to squeeze him, I could not stand the thought of that little boy seeing his father incarcerated. It is virtually impossible to fight a divorce when you're in prison and not getting out soon. Our assets, never much to begin with, were depleted after an 18-month pounding by the federal government. We had lost everything but our child and our commitment to each other. The child was a rock. The commitment bit the dust. Dion made some beautiful promises about persevering and toughing it out. But once I was gone, reality set in. She felt lonely and isolated in our small town. "People see me and they whisper," she wrote in one of her first letters. "I'm so lonely," she whined in another. It wasn't long before the letters became noticeably shorter and further apart, as did the visits. Dion grew up in Philadelphia and never warmed to life in the country. When an uncle offered her a job, she was suddenly in a hurry to go home. She remarried 2 years ago, and Bo, now 11, is being coached by another father. My last 20 letters to my son went unanswered. I'm sure he never saw them. I often wonder if I will see him again. I think I will make the effort, though I vacillate on this. How do you confront a child you love so much it hurts, but who will not recognize you? We are never going to live together again as a typical father and son. Would it be fair to Bo to have his long-lost father reappear and insist on becoming part of his life? I have far too much time to think about this. I am inmate number 44861-127 at the federal prison camp near Frostburg, Maryland. A camp is a low-security facility for those of us who are deemed nonviolent and sentenced to 10 years or less. For reasons that were never made clear, my first 22 months were spent at a medium security joint near Louisville, Kentucky. In the endless alphabet muck of bureau speak, it is known as an FCI, Federal Correctional Institution, and it was a far different place than my camp at Frostburg. An FCI is for violent men sentenced to more than 10 years. Life there is much tougher.
That was The Racketeer by John Grisham. Gangsters and Crime at Christmas time? The devil made me do it. I promise, next week, we're back to holiday favorites. If you're looking for milder fare, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today, and see you back here next week for the Book Report.